Hey there, I'm Stephen Dubner. This summer, we are revisiting favorite episodes from the Freakonomics Radio Archive. Today's episode is one of my very favorites. It's called The Cobra Effect. Feel free to check out our entire archive at freakonomics.com. And as always, thanks for listening.
So I'm Vikas Mehrotra. I teach finance at the University of Alberta in Canada.
So where are you? Where am I speaking to you?
I'm in Bogota, Colombia.
You're in Bogota. What are you doing there?
I was here for CFO Summit. I was doing some talks on corporate governance.
How's the traffic there, I'm wondering?
Right now, from the window of my room, it looks beautiful. It's flowing, but then I'm in a residential area.
Ah.
When you get to the city's main arteries, it moves with all the elegance of snails.
Fast snails or slow snails?
Slow snails.
When I talked to Mehrotra, he was staying at a hotel in Bogota a few miles away from the university campus where he was giving his talks. And every day, he'd get a ride to the campus from friends of his, a couple of professors who teach at the university. One thing struck Mehrotra as very strange. His friends never picked him up in the same car 2 days in a row.
So we are at the Bogota Sheraton parking lot.
We sent reporter John Otis out one morning to take a ride with Mehrotra and his friends.
So what kind of car is this?
A Chevy Optra, I can read it here. The license plate is RMM660. And it's the last digit, the zero, that's important.
Now, Bogota has legendarily bad traffic and the pollution that goes along with it. City officials have tried all kinds of solutions, including license plate rationing.
Welcome on board.
That's Alexander Guzman, one of Mehrotra's friends and chauffeurs. Guzman pulls out a newspaper and reads the prevailing driving rules.
You are not allowed to drive a car if your license plate ends in 1, 2, 3, 4 on Friday. On Monday, if your license plate ends in 5, 6, 7, 8, it's the same. You are not allowed to go out.
Bogota was not alone in trying this, trying to cut down on traffic by allowing certain cars on the road on certain days. Mexico City has done it, Athens, Beijing, when it hosted the 2008 Olympics. But what do you do if you need to drive every day, or at least want to drive every day? Guzman came up with a workaround.
We decided to buy two cars.
Do lots of people that you know buy two cars because of this license plate system?
Yes, yes. For example, our dean was telling us that they have four cars in their home because his wife works in another company and they live outside the city, so they need four cars.
That sounds crazy.
Yes. Yes, but it's the solution that everyone is implementing to avoid the restriction.
You might think, as I first thought, that it'd be easier to just make or buy fake license plates. And indeed, we're told that such a black market has existed in Bogota. But that's illegal, and the penalties are apparently stiff enough to discourage fake plates. So what do? You do the perfectly legal thing and buy a second car. Now, that's not what Bogota had in mind when it introduced the license plate scheme. And we don't have enough data to know what effect it's had, but there is good data from the license plate rationing plan in Mexico City. Turns out that a lot of people there also bought a second car to beat the system, and a lot of those cars were older models, less energy efficient. So the net result? After the license plate regulation went into effect in Mexico City, the regulation that was designed to cut congestion, total driving went up.
This is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Do you believe in economics? If you do, even a little bit, then you also believe in incentives, that people respond to incentives, whether they're financial incentives or something else. And that's why all of us, individuals, families, firms, governments, when we have a problem we want to solve, we come up with some kind of incentive scheme. But do you also believe in poetry? It was the Scottish poet Robert Burns who wrote about the best-laid plans of mice and men and how they often go awry. How awry do they go? Not just a little bit awry. The best-laid incentive plans sometimes not only don't work, but they backfire completely. Here, again, is Vikas Mehrotra.
This is what in economics we call the cobra effect, where you have a well-intended scheme, but instead of solving the problem, it makes the problem actually worse.
This term, the cobra effect, it goes back a while.
So the cobra effect refers to a scheme in colonial India where the British governor or whoever the person in charge in Delhi wanted to rid Delhi of cobras. Apparently, in his opinion, there were too many cobras in Delhi. So he had the bounty placed on cobras. And he expected this would solve the problem. But the population in Delhi, at least some of it, responded by farming cobras. And all of a sudden, the administration was getting too many cobra skins. And they decided the scheme wasn't as smart as initially it appeared. And they rescinded the scheme. But by then, the cobra farmers had this little population of cobras to deal with. And what do you do if there's no market? You just release them.
Ah.
And so this significantly, by a few orders of magnitude, worsened the cobra menace in Delhi.
I'm pushing for the rat effect in lieu of the cobra effect.
That's Michael Vann. He is a history professor at Sacramento State University. And this here is Catherine Wells. Say hi, Catherine.
Hi.
She used to be a producer on our show. Catherine, we sent you out to look for other instances of the cobra effect, did we not?
Yes. And this led me to Michael Vann. So Vann did his graduate research on colonial Vietnam. And that meant he spent a lot of time in the French National Archives looking at old urban planning documents for Hanoi. Boring stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But one day, he got to this file on sewers.
Not boring.
No, not boring. And he came across this.
There was a list of rats killed in a day. And it was the most interesting thing I'd seen in a couple months.
But let me back up a little bit to a time before that list.
Okay.
Around the turn of the century, the French were rebuilding Hanoi. And, you know, the French are French, so they didn't want it to be just any city. It was going to be a model city. We're talking evidence of French civilization, the most beautiful city in Asia.
And one of the key elements of French urbanism, in addition to the beautiful buildings and the wide streets, were sewers. Unfortunately, there was one unintended consequence, and that's that the sewers provided a wonderful home for rats. So after the sewer system was laid, there started to be reports of rats coming up through the flush toilets into the stately villas of the French neighborhood, thus undermining the French sense of superiority and the prestige they enjoyed in living in the nicest, most advanced part of the city.
It was the rat highway.
It's the rat superhighway, yeah. And the situation became all the more serious during moments of bubonic plague outbreak. And here you have the bubonic plague, which the French viewed as a Vietnamese problem, making its way into the French neighborhoods because the rats are overpopulating the sewers in the French neighborhood, coming into the homes of the French families. And you start to have European cases of bubonic plague and some of the outbreaks in the early 20th century after the opening of the sewers.
So the French get very freaked out by this, and they decide they need to act fast. They hire a bunch of Vietnamese exterminators to go down into the sewers and kill the rats, which is where we come back to that list that Vann found in the archives.
So this is compiled in the spring and summer of 1902, and it's a list of the total rat kills. In the first week, they're pulling up hundreds of rats. A month into the project, they're pulling up in one day on May 19th, 7,442. The high point, I believe, according to these records, was in June 12th, 1902. They killed 20,114 rats.
20,000 rats killed in a day.
In a day. And this is, you know, I'm looking at the spreadsheet here, and I'm looking at numbers 7,000, 6,000, 8,000, 7,000, 10,000, 11,000, 15,000, 9,000. So there seems to be an endless supply of rats. They're not making a dent on it.
Clearly, the French are going to need more than a few exterminators to solve the problem. And someone has an idea.
They decide that they're going to turn to the civic responsibility of the Vietnamese residents of Hanoi. So they set out a bounty.
To collect the cash bounty, people had to bring in the rats' tails as proof of their kills.
Thousands of rat tails are being delivered to the city hall. The French think they're really making a dent into the rat population. Then a few months later, one of the health officials is out in the suburbs of Hanoi, just outside the city limits. And it's just outside the city limits where a lot of shady business would go on. You'd have smugglers out there, you'd have houses of ill repute and so forth. And he was checking out one of these villages on the edge of Hanoi and discovered a rat farm. And the Vietnamese were growing rats, cutting off their tails and bringing them into the city, to the city hall, to collect the bounty. You know, this is absolutely a disaster in terms of trying to remove rats, but it does show that the Vietnamese are really catching on with the entrepreneurial spirit that the French wanted to instill in them.
As we've said before on this program, and we'll surely say again, one of the most powerful laws of nature is the law of unintended consequences. Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, do you have what it takes to be a rat farmer?
I don't think I would have been smart enough to actually get the idea to start breeding rats and cobras, but I sure hope I would have been smart enough that when I saw my neighbor doing it, I would have been a quick follower and I would have been buying a few rats off him cheap.
Every week, we put out a Freakonomics Radio podcast. We ask questions like, does doing good give you license to be bad? And what does a CEO actually do? The best part about our podcast, it's free. To subscribe, visit us at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or at Freakonomics.com. Freakonomics Radio is supported by the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985 supporting progress in education, science, and the arts. Information at cysimsfoundation.org.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Progressive Insurance, providing tools designed to help customers consider options from multiple insurers. Comparisons available at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Now that's progressive.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Today we're talking about the cobra effect, which is what happened in the old days when a government wanted to, say, get rid of some pests, snakes or rats, and they'd set up a bounty to get its citizenry to pitch in. But sometimes the bounty would backfire. Now, surely that kind of thing doesn't happen anymore, does it?
Okay. It is Monday morning. I'm sitting in the car. I am about to drive out to Fort Benning.
That's producer Catherine Wells again. This time, she's in Fort Benning, Georgia.
Fort Benning is an army base, which is technically called a military post, in southwestern Georgia. And once you're inside, past the checkpoint, Fort Benning looks a lot like any other town. There are residential neighborhoods, schools, restaurants, gas stations. It's huge. It's over twice the land area of Atlanta with about 120,000 residents. There are lush green woods, ponds, and creeks cutting through bright red soil. It's really beautiful. So beautiful, in fact, that you might forget you were on a military installation.
Whoa.
if not for the occasional sound of artillery fire in the distance.
They're over there training.
That's Bill Brickner. He's a retired master sergeant and a Vietnam vet who knows the post inside and out. He's legendary around here. In fact, his business card says so.
Bill Hog Daddy Brickner, local hunting legend. That's a big title, isn't it? That don't even sound like me, girl. But most people, they say, when you want to know something about Fort Benning, you got to ask Bill Brickner.
I did want to know something about Fort Benning, something that Brickner has a little expertise in. I wanted to know about the pigs. If you live anywhere in the southeastern U.S., you probably already know about the pigs. There are millions of wild pigs living in forests and mountains and marshes all over the country. They've been in the U.S. for centuries, ever since they were brought over by Spanish explorers, but their numbers have exploded in the last few decades. And like most invasive species, they cause some problems.
They're a nuisance, and they need to be controlled. It's amazing what a pig will eat.
Pigs dig up the land looking for food, and even just a handful of pigs can do a massive amount of damage. And on Fort Benning, there aren't just lawns and native plants to tear up, but expensive military training equipment, too. So when he can, Bill Brickner loads his gun into the back of his truck, and he goes out for a little recreational pest control.
See, we joke about it. We say, when you're not shooting a pig, those pigs are out there, they're making bacon.
Recreational hunting by retirees like Brickner isn't enough to control the population. There are still thousands of pigs on the post, causing problems. And back in the summer of 2007, this situation was getting out of control.
They had to do something. Pigs were getting into everything. And they used to say, man, what are we going to do about the pig situation?
It was time for a bounty. The bounty had a name. They called it the Pig Eradication Program. Fort Benning loosened up a few restrictions about where and when you could hunt, and they essentially said, have at 'em. You could even leave the pig right where it was killed. As for proof of the kill, all you had to do was bring in the tail.
They would give $40 a tail. You know, it paid for your gas, paid for your ammunition. It gave you an incentive to go out and stay all day long.
Now, at the time, Fort Benning was also confronting the pig problem in a different way. They had hired some researchers from nearby Auburn University to do a study and to figure out if there were any new, better ways to remove pigs from the post.
I have a fondness for pigs, which is kind of odd considering how many pigs I've had to kill.
This is Rob Holtfreder. He was working on his PhD in wildlife sciences at Auburn, and he headed up the pig research. He would track pigs on the post with GPS, trap them, kill them, and then he'd bring them back to the university for dissection. When the bounty went into place in 2007, Fort Benning asked Holtfreder to monitor its effect, to figure out if it was working. And when it began, he estimated that there were maybe around 1,000 pigs on the post. A year and a half into the program, hunters had already killed over 1,000 pigs, which you'd think would mean the pig population was pretty much under control. But when Holtfreder sat down with his tracking and trapping data, that's not what he found. What he found was this.
The population was growing. And it's like, holy cow, we just saw that population double like that. And then we're kind of out there trying to explain to these people how they supposedly killed the number of pigs that they did, but density is increasing. And it's like, we killed 1,500 pigs, but you know, you're saying the density went up. How's it possible? And we're like, good question. How is that possible?
Now, along with each tail, hunters were supposed to turn in an information sheet with details about how, when, and most importantly, where they killed each pig. Rob Holtfreder started looking at the data from the sheets.
Everything I know about pigs tells me that you couldn't have killed that many pigs in that small of an area in that amount of time. And there were some of those locations where you're like, that's the top of John Wayne Hill. It's sand. You know, they run tanks through there. Nobody killed 30 pigs in that spot. So yeah, there was a lot of that. Like, we have specific knowledge of this location. And not only that, I mean, we have specific knowledge of the pigs in that location. And this just doesn't sync up that so-and-so says in the last 2 weeks they've killed 30 pigs there. And not only that, but I don't think anybody could be that successful.
But if the tales weren't coming from Fort Benning, where were they coming from?
That's a guard dog. A ferocious guard dog.
Oh, yeah. I'm scared. Brothers Johnny and Jason Daffin run a family business called Daffin's Meat Processing, not too far from Fort Benning.
We do custom slaughter, so we do cows and hogs, sheep, goats, anybody you don't like, and get a little more for that, though.
Jason Daffin was in the middle of skinning a wild sow when I stopped by.
A little wild, probably about an 80-pound little female pig, just the right eating size.
So where'd this one come from?
Fort Benning. They get a lot of them at Fort Benning. They're kind of a nuisance. They're like an armadillo on steroids. They can really tear up the land quick.
So one thing I wanted to ask you is, I've been talking to people about the bounty and you turned in the tail and everything, and I was wondering, did anybody ever just call you and want to get your tails?
Yeah, but that's not, you know, right's right and wrong's wrong, and that's just not the way we operate. But there weren't many people like that at all. It was a good program, and they would just one every now and again call up, say they didn't want their tail, save me them tails, or people wanting to go and get them off of domestic hogs and all that. So they kind of, and even some people would kill a pregnant sow and want to get the tails off the little babies that weren't even born yet. So you have all kind of people out there, you know, trying to take advantage of the system.
Do you have a tail? Can I see one? Do you have any lying around?
Let's see. Not an unusual request.
Daffin opened a big bucket, and there were a bunch of pig parts inside.
Look at that.
There it is.
There's your old hogtail in all its glory. It's not exactly curly Q like what you see on the cartoon. It's just kind of straight hairy pigtail.
I wanted to know if other people had gotten these same kinds of calls, so I stopped by another business that does meat processing. It's called Buckhead Taxidermy. The owner is James Curtin.
Oh, I'm sure everybody did. Whether they tell they did or not, I don't know, but I'm sure they did.
I mean, I wouldn't be surprised with all the tail fever if you could start a tail business.
Well, a friend of mine had a pig farm, and he said they was wanting to buy the tails off his pigs. You know, he can sell these little pigs cheap, and they'll buy these pigs just to get the tails off of them.
I mean, really?
Yeah, you can buy a little baby pig for $5 or $10, and, you know, if they're giving $45 for a pigtail, gosh, look at the money that would be.
So to collect the cash, hunters needed to bring in their tails to the Fort Benning Conservation Office, which deals with all sorts of wildlife issues. Biologist Mark Thornton and technician Gregory Brooks work on staff in the office. They spend a lot of time trapping and removing pigs from the base, so they're really the local experts on the pigs. Now, they weren't so crazy about the idea of a bounty to begin with. They really didn't think it would work. So I figured if suspicious tails had come in, they might have known about it. So here's what I want to ask about. If you get $40 per pigtail, it makes total sense that people might start trying to get pigtails somewhere else. Did that happen? Can you tell me that, or no?
I don't want to tell you that.
You could say no comment.
No comment.
No comment from you, Mark?
I don't have any record of it happening. Now, whether it happened or not, we don't know.
Were you worried about it? Was it kind of like...
Well, obviously everybody thinks about that, you know. Because, I mean, you came in here with 10 tails. That's $400. That's enough incentive to make some people start thinking about it.
There's definitely the possibility that at some point somebody broke the rules. And that's expected when you're talking about bounty programs.
So pretty much every time there's a bounty, there's some of that involved.
I'm quite sure of it. Sometimes you get a reverse effect of what you're trying to do, you know. Overall, it upside downs the whole idea you're trying to accomplish.
Almost everyone I talked to at Fort Benning had heard these rumors about people buying tails from domestic pig farms. But no one really thought the cheating was that widespread either. And even if lots of the tails had been coming from somewhere else, there was still that nagging question. Why was the pig population going up? One factor was that southwestern Georgia was just beginning to recover from a drought, so there was a lot more food for pigs out in the woods. But the bounty was making things worse, because in order to help the hunters draw the pigs out of the woods, Fort Benning started giving out free bait. Here's Rob Holtfreder again from Auburn University.
They could back up to any cafeteria and fill up like a 40-gallon bucket full of waste left over from the meals, and it's like, you'd see like butter packets and steaks and dinner rolls and just like high calorie stuff that you shouldn't feed an invasive species. And then they'd go out and dump it in these long lines, you know, and we'd see them. And, you know, you might have 15 or 20 pigs in an area. You might pull up and kill three or four from the road. And meanwhile, the other 15 are fat and happy. And they're also figuring out what the crunch of a tire on gravel sounds like. They're figuring out what's going on. It's like, well, we've got a free meal, but we've got to, you know, watch out for these warning signs. And they educated pigs. And they fed them, and they fed them really well.
And what happens when you feed pigs really well?
They make more pigs.
I wanted to see these pigs in the flesh. So I asked Bill Brickner, the local hunting legend, to take me on a drive around the post.
Now, right here, we're pulling into this cornfield, and pigs are just annihilated this cornfield.
Brickner showed me how and where to look for them. He showed me what their tracks look like, how they rub red clay against the trees to scratch themselves. He showed me indentations in the mud where they've laid down to wallow. But we drove around for 3 hours and we didn't see a single pig. And I started to think, hey, maybe they finally have this thing under control. But at dusk, as soon as it started to cool off, whoa! How many are there, Bill?
There's 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Look, there are more. Oh, my gosh.
Okay, so there's 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16.
After 3 years and about $125,000 in payments, the bounty ended. Thousands of pigs had been reported killed. Now, there's no way to know exactly how many of the tails weren't from Fort Benning, but what's clear is that the end of the drought, plus the tons and tons of extra bait, helped the pig population to grow. All the hunters had really been doing was playing a giant, unwinnable game of whack-a-mole. That's amazing. There's just tons of them.
There's 600-800 pounds right there of meat.
So, Bill, if you had been hunting, how would that have been different, what we just did?
Oh, right there, I would have shot that pig right in the head.
That was Catherine Wells, reporting from Fort Benning, Georgia. So while the evidence from the Georgia pig bounty is a bit murky, the pattern here is pretty clear. An incentive, like a bounty, doesn't always have the intended effect. Now, I realize that most of the stories we've told you today have concerned animals, feral pigs and sewer rats, overbred cobras, but I can assure you that the backfiring bounty problem is not confined to icky animals. Consider an incentive scheme that the United Nations came up with a few years ago to cut down on greenhouse gases. It rewarded companies with carbon credits for disposing of polluting gases, and those credits could be converted into cold hard cash. Now, the prices were set according to how bad these things were for the environment, and one of the highest prices, one of the highest bounties, really, was for destroying a nasty gas called HFC-23, which is a byproduct of a common coolant. So what happened? Yep, companies began to produce more and more of this coolant in order to destroy more and more of the byproduct waste gas and collect millions of dollars in the process. The other problem was that the coolant itself was also really bad for the environment.
Some of the best-intentioned government policies have backfired through incentives.
That's Steve Levitt, my Freakonomics friend and co-author. He's an economist at the University of Chicago.
One example would be the Endangered Species Act, which, of course, by its very name, is designed to save endangered species. But the way it was written into law, there's a review period. So before any particular species can be named as endangered, the first is maybe, I forget the exact amount of time, a year or 2 years, in which people are able to argue back and forth about whether it should be the case.
So while these human beings are arguing back and forth about whether a particular habitat should be protected in order to save a particular species, some other human beings are quickly firing up their chainsaws.
What do you do if you're a developer in the meantime? Well, you build the buildings as fast as possible. If you think that there's a chance that the red-bellied woodpecker is going to be protected by the Endangered Species Act, you have every incentive in the world to get the hotel up before anyone decides that that species is really endangered. So actually, there's empirical work by my friend John List, who's shown that indeed the Endangered Species Act often has the effect of endangering the various species it's supposed to protect.
So as an economist, you preach that people respond to incentives.
I do believe heartily in incentives. And I think any problem you're faced with, the typical economist, including myself, starts by asking, what are the incentives of the people involved and how can we get them to respond?
But when we hear these stories of incentives that are created, and these are incentive programs that don't work out, what's a well-intentioned public servant or even private citizen to do? You think you're doing the right thing, you think you're coming up with the right idea, you're well-intentioned, and you offer your incentive scheme, and then the public, the world responds to it maybe in a way that you had never anticipated. So how are you supposed to unleash these things in the world?
Well, I think you start by admitting to yourself that no individual, no government is ever going to be as smart as the people who are scheming against you. So when you introduce an incentive scheme, you have to just admit to yourself that no matter how clever you think you are, there's a pretty good chance that someone far more clever than yourself will figure a way to beat the incentive scheme. So one response is to say, well, before I put it in place, let me at least try to think through all of the crazy different approaches that might be taken that could trick my incentive scheme. But even on top of that, I think you want to design incentive schemes that are relatively simple. The more complicated you make something, the more opportunities there are for people to game it. If it's simple, you usually think, if you're reasonably intelligent, you can think about a lot of the ways that people might respond to it and prevent these sort of unexpected, backfiring, overly zealous responses to what you're doing.
All right. Imagine yourself 100 years ago, let's say, living in Hanoi or India, and the government offers an incentive, a bounty for a pest, a rodent, a rat, maybe a cobra. And let's say you're a person of humble means, you, Steve Levitt, living back then. Would you have been the kind of guy that would have figured out a way to take advantage of that bounty and raise and slaughter hundreds, thousands of rats, cobras, et cetera? Or are you not that kind of guy?
So I don't think I would have been smart enough to actually get the idea to start breeding rats and cobras. But I sure hope I would have been smart enough that when I saw my neighbor doing it, I would have been a quick follower, and I would have been buying a few rats off him cheap, one male and four or five females, and then making the most of it. So I would hope I would be that kind of person.
Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, we leave behind those backfiring bounties and focus instead on the bountiful beauty of Winston Churchill's words and how much they cost.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by TransferWise, an online service that lets people send and receive currencies internationally, and their borderless account lets customers hold and convert multiple currencies at any time. More at TransferWise.com and the app.
This is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Let's play a piece of a Churchill speech. We'll worry later about whether how much
whose tab it goes on.
Exactly.
We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it when subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old.
So, first of all, astonishing language. I mean,
which he crafted meticulously. Mm. There wasn't a comma or even a breath that I don't think was choreographed in advance. He was a performer as a speaker.
Now, Churchill coined a number of things that Churchill said throughout history have become ingrained in our language. Never give in, is it? Or give in. Yeah. Do I now, having said those words on this program, need to send a check to somebody? How does it work?
Yes, I think you should send it to me, and I'll forward it.
Thank you. Barry Singer is a writer, the author of several books about music and the theater, and for the past 30 years, he has also run a shop in New York City called Chartwell Booksellers. It's a regular bookshop, but it specializes in Churchilliana, that is, books, manuscripts, and artifacts that relate to the long and storied life of Sir Winston Spencer Churchill. Chartwell, in fact, is the name of Churchill's home in Kent in southeast England. Despite knowing a great deal about Churchill, and despite having written several books, it wasn't until recently that Barry Singer himself wrote a book about Churchill. It's called Churchill's Style, The Art of Being Winston Churchill. And in the course of writing the book, something strange happened, something having to do with Churchill's estate and money and Barry Singer. But before we get to that, let's hear a bit more about Churchill himself and his well-appointed life.
I love the fact that away from his life, he nurtured himself, it seemed to me, in a very holistic and fascinating way, so that he had the strength to weather all the defeat that was actually part of his career. Churchill lost, I think, at least five elections in the course of his career. He was constantly swatted down. He was constantly dismissed, including at the end of World War II. Before the war ended, he was voted out of office as prime minister. And I believe that the life that he created for himself away from politics was the source of his strength. And that included everything from how he dressed. He liked comfortable clothing.
Those jumpsuits he designed.
And he designed a jumpsuit for himself that he could zip down to the floor so he could step in and step out of it. Mm-hmm. Pretty amazing. Had it made up in all these different fabrics. So he had a dress one, and he had one for painting, and he had one that he wore with medals. Everything he wore was bespoke. Obviously, he was into very fine fabrics and things like that. But at the same time, he built Chartwell. He kind of renovated it with his own hands, obviously with the help of professionals. But he was in there designing and recreating the house himself. So he was very much a hands-on, fix-it sort of personality.
Let me lead you on a tangent just for a minute, because it gets to where where I want to go with you eventually, let's say somebody listening to this knows nothing about Winston Churchill. They know that he existed. He was prime minister of Britain during the war, and he did some other stuff, okay? One would assume that he was a fabulously wealthy human being. One would have assumed, however, wrongly. So talk about, you know, there's a lot in your book about money, what it meant to him, how he used it, how he was in some ways very savvy. But also, he lived like a king, not on a king's salary. So talk about that for a minute.
You have to remember that his father was the son of the Duke of Marlborough, but he was not the inheriting son, so he came away from that with nothing. He was also kind of frivolous with money himself, so Churchill inherited only, for the most part, his father's debts. But he figured out very early on that the only thing that he could do to make money quickly was to write. He was a very good writer.
Had Winston Churchill not gotten into politics, had he not finally won an election and eventually become PM and all these other things, any idea what kind of career he would have had as a literary figure alone?
He won the Nobel Prize for Literature.
No, I'm just saying, like—
I think he was a good enough writer that he would have become—he would have remained a writer, I think. But it's also important to point out that he joined the army to get into Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
He knew that he wanted to become a famous war hero, war correspondent— so that he could run for Parliament. He always wanted politics. He wanted to do what his father had done and best him. And, you know, and you have to remember also that until the 1920s, Parliament, nobody was paid a salary who served in Parliament. So there was no money in it. Mostly you had to go in there with your own money.
Okay, so here's a young man who had his sights set on politics, saw the military and writing about being in the military as an avenue toward that goal. Everything works out. He gets that goal. He becomes a politician. The story goes on. Had he been only a writer, he probably would have been, as you say, a very successful writer and probably would have made plenty of money to sustain what he wanted to accomplish. Talk for just one more minute then about him for the rest of his life and money and where the money came from to support himself during and after politics.
First of all, the money came from the writing, but he then spent it. He spent it liberally. He spent it on Paul Roger champagne, which he bought in staggering quantities, and vintages that he preferred he bought out, as he would buy everything that he could find. And he bought cigars. I have bills. The Churchill Archives have preserved. He saved everything. So the Churchill Archives in Cambridge have everything, all of the bills. So you can see what he was buying from nine different cigar emporiums all across London. And it's an unbelievable thousands of cigars. But when he got into trouble, he took investment advice from a number of important people, and he was close to the Rothschild family. His father had been close to the Rothschild family. But some of these people bailed Churchill out when he got in too deep.
Churchill himself died in 1965, yes?
Correct.
He was an old man. He lived
90.
90. Did he die a rich man? Did he leave a whole lot of money to his heirs?
He did not. One of the reasons that Churchill was able to stay on at Chartwell, which he would have sold, I think, after the war because it was just too expensive to maintain, is that, again, friends of his stepped up and said, we will buy Chartwell from you. We will raise a subscription to buy it from you, and you will be able to live there at a very nominal rent for the rest of your life. And when it's done, it'll become a National Trust property and a museum. And that's exactly what happened. And that's why the building is preserved today and is very much as it was when he left it, because he lived there until the day he died. And then Clementine lived there, and then it was turned over to the National Trust. So he didn't have much to leave to his grandchildren except the copyrights to his works.
So Barry Singer, proprietor of a New York bookshop that specializes in the works of Winston Churchill, is writing a book about Churchill to be called Churchill's Style. He gets in touch with the literary agency, Curtis Brown, which oversees the Churchill estate.
I contacted them to let them know that I was doing this book and was surprised to learn, they told me, that any word of Churchill's, either written or uttered in public, was copyrighted by the Churchill estate and that I would have to pay a royalty to quote from Churchill.
Now, it should be said that Singer, as a dealer in old Churchill books and artifacts, is quite friendly with the estate, Churchill's children and grandchildren. He's done business with them. They've visited his shop in New York. He's visited them in their homes in England. So he hadn't been expecting to pay merely to quote Churchill in his book.
I was shocked. What I assumed was that, as we've all written, quoting throughout our writing career, you abstract a certain amount of words and you quote. You don't necessarily quote an entire book, but you can quote selected passages without.
Right, there are laws, fair use.
Paying
rights,
fair
right,
use.
Right. So tell me what you began to learn about the United Kingdom's fair use or somewhat fair use.
Well, there
law.
Is no fair, okay. fair use in the United Kingdom. Right. It's every man for himself
Lack
in the United
of, yeah,
Kingdom.
Yeah, yeah.
And the way it was explained to me was the Bill of Rights, that free speech in the United States, because it is in the Bill of Rights, you actually are allowed to quote more liberally than you are in the United Kingdom, which has no Bill of Rights. And the Magna Carta did not guarantee that anybody could quote whatever they wanted to, or that anyone, that there was... I don't quite get it. I still don't think that... And I actually had an attorney here who said to me, you know, I think that you could push this if you wanted to, and I don't think they have a leg to stand
push
on
push this
legally.
Meaning write whatever you want, include the Churchill quotes.
And let them come after you, and I think you would win the case in court. However, I have, as I say, warm relations with the Churchill family and have no interest whatsoever in crossing them or doing anything that they don't want me to do. And I did go to members of the Churchill family and say to them, is this real?
Give me a specific. You're saying, like, for instance, a speech, let's mm-hmm. say, right, that Churchill has made. And you're saying you would like to quote whatever, 20 words, 50 words, 80 words from the speech. The agent has told you, yes, you may license his words via me for on behalf of the estate, and it will cost you what, X
he
cents
said
a word?
How does £500 per 1,000 words quoted.
Ooh. So you, as a writer of a book about Churchill, if you want to include quotations from Churchill, even if those were made while, let's say, he was prime minister before Parliament, you would have to pay the Churchill estate nearly a buck a word.
That's right. As long as it was delivered, 70 years was the statute of limitations, and 70 years did not apply if it was the first time any of this was being quoted.
Uh-huh. Interesting
then,
wrinkle.
Which okay. was an interesting wrinkle. Yeah. That surprised me.
Yeah. So when you learned that every time you would quote Churchill himself, whether from public or private writing or speech, in the book that you're writing about Churchill, how did that affect your writing of that Churchill book then?
I cut every quote to the bone. I was shaving quotes. I was cutting participles.
You didn't have to pay for ellipses.
The ellipses were flying. I was cutting like crazy. I'll tell you also that every member of the Churchill family it applied to as well. So if I had quotes of Clementine, and the rate for Clementine was higher than the rate for Winston.
Wow. I'm guessing Clementine went out the window in your book then.
She was gone. I wrote to Curtis Brown and I said, if you do this, Clementine will be eliminated from the book as a voice. I'll just paraphrase her. And they said to me, be careful about paraphrasing. But I did. God knows, I hope that they still like me over there, but this is the fact. This is what happened.
Okay. I want to know then, if you're willing to say, how much you had to pay. So the way book writing works, for those who don't know, is typically an author will get an advance, which is an advance against royalties. So if your book sells a lot, your publisher will get the money back that they paid you in the advance, and then you'll start sharing profits. But the author gets an advance that you use to fund yourself to do the research and write the book. Do you want to say either or both, how much you had to pay to the estate, the Churchill estate, and or what share of your advance it constituted?
Well, I do know because of the contract we ultimately signed that I used 3,872 words of Winston Churchill's in the book. Mm-hmm. And that cost me £950, mm-hmm. which is roughly 40 cents a word. So they did bring
gave
it,
you a nice
they
break.
Did bring it down
yeah.
somewhat. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that my entire advance went to photo and word rights in the end.
Do you regret, therefore, in any direction having written the book?
No. I've never, unlike Churchill, I have a day job because I've never written entirely for money. I really wanted to write this book, and I'm really glad to see it. And the rest is the future. Maybe it will generate some money, but all the advance money went into the book.
We contacted Gordon Wise. He's a representative of the Churchill Estates Literary Agency. He told us by email that what surprised him was that Singer was surprised that he'd have to pay to quote Churchill, especially since Singer is not only a writer but a bookseller who makes his living reselling the words that others have written.
Gordon Wise added, quote, "You would not expect your possessions to become common property on your death. You would expect to be able to will them to those you wish to enjoy them, to benefit from them, and to exploit them mindful of your wishes." If you're a writer like Barry Singer, who's been trained in American journalism, the idea of paying to quote the words of a public official may seem strange. But just because you're not accustomed to something doesn't necessarily make it wrong. Rules differ, laws differ, estates differ. James Joyce's grandson, Stephen James Joyce, is so protective of his grandfather's words that he is the bane of many a Joyce scholar. The estate of Martin Luther King Jr. charged about $800,000 for the use of his likeness and words in the King Memorial in Washington, D.C. Now, every case is different. A public memorial is not the same as a book, which is not the same as a TV commercial. And the UK is not the same as the US. As most scholars will tell you, UK laws are much more protective and, as a result, much more convoluted on many levels. So much so, in fact, that the government has gotten involved. So, Rohan, this conversation began when I was visiting you in London. I told you about this friend of mine. I don't know if you remember this conversation at all, about Churchill, my friend writing the Churchill book.
Yeah, absolutely. Remember it well.
Rohan Silva runs a couple startups in the UK. When we first aired this episode, he was a senior policy advisor to British Prime Minister David Cameron. He covered a lot of ground in that job, including reform of Britain's archaic copyright system.
Well, I think the big point to make is that the British system doesn't have a very specific characteristic that the American system does. You over there have fair use exemptions in intellectual property. We just don't have those in the UK. So some of the kind of examples of absurdities might include medical researchers doing data mining across large numbers of data sets and patient records and so on quickly fall foul in the UK of copyright laws. Another example is that we've had lots of cultural institutions, museums and galleries, coming to us saying, we've got tapes, old videotapes, spools of tapes rotting in our basements because we can't digitize them. Because in digitizing, you are changing the format, which requires permission from the copyright holder. And with a lot of these old 1920s, 1930s films and recordings, the copyright holder can't be found. And so these tapes are left rotting for fear of litigation. So, you know, we're really seeing these absurdities abound.
In order to minimize these absurdities, the Cameron administration commissioned a report to look into updating the UK's intellectual property regime. The report's author, a well-regarded scholar named Ian Hargraves, came back with three key recommendations. First, the government should create a digital copyright exchange that would make it easy for a user to find out who owns a piece of content and pay him for it. Second, the government should facilitate the use of what are called orphaned works, those rotting tapes sitting in basements, for instance, by allowing a fair use exemption if the owner of such works cannot be found. And the third one, is the biggie. It has to do with data mining. It would make it easier for researchers of various kinds to sort through massive piles of data. As Rohan Silva sees it, the liberalization of this copyright restriction will change the game. In the meantime, until IP law in the UK is modernized, if you want to write a book about, let's say, Winston Churchill, it's going to cost you. By the way, I'd like to point out that an American radio project like ours is not subject to British copyright law or the reach of Winston Churchill's literary agent or his estate, which means that we can play you his majestic words freely and for free. And thus, we shall.
Prodigious hammer strokes have been needed to bring us together today. If you will allow me to use other language, I will say that he must indeed have a blind soul who cannot see that some great purpose and design is being worked out here below, of which we have the honor to be the faithful servant. It is not given to us to peer into the mysteries of the future. Still I avow my hope and faith, sure and inviolate, that in the days to come, the British and American peoples will, for their own safety and for the good of all, walk together in majesty, in justice, and in peace.
I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with a brand new episode. If you can't wait that long, you can find our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at freakonomics.com or at Apple Podcasts, where you can also subscribe.